Thank you very much, Vanaraji. Okay. So, enlightenment. Well, it's rather a big topic, obviously. And it's hard to know what to say about enlightenment, especially when I'm not enlightened. So it's not something I have much personal knowledge about, and it's difficult, therefore, to speak authoritatively about it. So I think the best clues about the Buddha's enlightenment are provided in the Pali Canon. And there are many accounts there of the Buddha's first utterances after he became enlightened. And then as well as that, there are all the teachings that have been passed down subsequently, which were the Buddha's attempts to convey that reality, or the, you know, convey that reality and the enlightenment experience and what it means. So what I'm going to do tonight is to look more at the Buddha's journey towards enlightenment, and look at some of the key events along the way and what meaning that they have for us today on our own journeys. And if I have time, I'd also like to talk a bit about how we actually relate to the Buddha and whether or not it's possible for us to have our own kind of personal, meaningful connection with him. So I'll just see how I go with time around that. So when I'm talking about the Buddha tonight, I'm talking about the actual historical personality. So the man who was born Siddhartha Gautama in the area which is now the border of northern India and Nepal, and where he became enlightened on the full moon night sometime April-May time in about 540 BCE, before Common Era. And I'd like to share one quote with you, which is something that the Buddha himself said much later about that experience of enlightenment. So he said, "Suppose a man wandering in a forest wilderness found an ancient path, an ancient trail, travelled by men of old, and he followed it, and by doing so he discovered an ancient city, an ancient royal capital, where men of old had lived, with parks and groves and lakes, walled around and beautiful to see. In such wise have I found the ancient path, the ancient trail, travelled by the fully enlightened ones of old." So according to tradition, there had been other Buddhas in the past who had achieved enlightenment in other eras. But the Buddha was the first one in our time, in our era, to find or to rediscover that ancient path. So he didn't inherit enlightenment. He wasn't born to be enlightened. It didn't happen. It wasn't necessarily going to happen. He attained enlightenment only after many years of struggle and effort, and even after making mistakes, which I find quite encouraging. So through the efforts he made in his life, he showed how we too, by our own efforts, can gain enlightenment. What the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome. What the Buddha attained, we too can attain. So most of you are probably familiar, or with at least some of the key events in Siddhartha's life. And although details of his life are quite limited in the Pali Canon, they have become embellished over time and have acquired the qualities of myth and legend. This doesn't necessarily make them untrue as such, but I think we have to be aware of the differences between historical and symbolic truth of the stories. So, according to the legend, he was brought up in great luxury and he was trained as a warrior. And he was trained to take over the headship of his clan, the Shakya clan. Despite the best attempts of his father to shield him from the harsher aspects of life, he eventually had the experience of what is known as the four sights. Some of you will have heard of these. And the experience of the four sights stands at the beginning, in a way, of his spiritual quest or spiritual journey. And it also stands at the beginning of our spiritual quest or spiritual journey. So the Buddha's four sights were of a sick person, an old person, a dead person, and a sadhu, or sadhu is a holy man, a holy wanderer. The first three sights brought him into relationship with dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness, for the first time. Probably wasn't literally for the first time, but that's how the story has been passed down to us, that these sights struck him very forcefully on this particular occasion and went in a particular kind of way, so he understood it in a particular very deep way. And they relate, these first three sights relate to the first of the four noble truths. So he realizes on a very deep level that he and everyone else is subject to old age, sickness and death. So for Siddhartha, the experience went in so deeply that he couldn't go back to his old life. That was it. It was sort of the point of no return. He was so unsettled that he knew he had to change his life completely. It was the fourth sight, the sight of the wandering sadhu, that suggested the way forward for him. And the sadhu was one who had gone forth into the homeless life to devote himself to the search for truth. So full-time, you know, wandering about, looking for answers. And Siddhartha was really inspired by this sight. He was struck by the man's demeanour and thought that maybe he would find the answer to the questions about suffering if he too sort of became a wanderer in the same way. So in a way, he didn't feel like he had any choice in the matter, but to change his life, to set off and try and make sense of this insight that he'd had. So he leaves behind his life of luxury in the palace, he leaves his wife and child, and he goes off on this noble quest, which is going to take him many years. He cuts off his hair, he exchanges his clothes with a beggar. The beggar got lucky that day, and goes in search of teachers. And I think what's good for us to do is to reflect or think about what our own experience is of the four sights. It's not that we haven't experienced suffering or unsatisfactoriness before in our lives, and obviously, you know, we've all been exposed to some extent to old age, sickness and death. But I think there usually comes a moment when our experience of the unsatisfactoriness of life or the way we're living it becomes intolerable, and we have some small insight into reality and we know we have to change. And once we've had an experience like that, if we don't take it on fully, if we don't change our lives, well, we've never really gone for refuge. We've never really made a commitment to the spiritual path. And so I was thinking about this in relation to myself. And my own experience of this happened when I was about 27, and I was living my life in a very particular way, which was the life of a full-time activist, very sort of full-on political activism. And I was living in Southeast Asia, and I was out on the streets on a huge march on this particular day with 250,000 people protesting at the assassination of a political leader. And I just remember marching along, and I suddenly had this vision of violence and counter-violence, you know, this big cycle of violence just stretching indefinitely into the future. And just realising that we were all caught up in it. We were all caught up in it. And even though we were protesting against the violence, a violent act that had happened, we were nevertheless part of that to some extent, we were caught in it and we were contributing to it and partly responsible for it too. So it felt like a very, very meaningful sort of, I called it a vision at the time. And unfortunately, of course, there were no wandering sadhus around there to show me the possibility of an alternative path. But, you know, nevertheless, I just knew in my being that I had to change and, you know, get out of that sort of cycle of repetitive violence. And then 4 months later, I travelled to Nepal, and there I made my first contact with Buddhism. And I think I remember that the words that kept resounding in me at that time were, I have to stop, I have to be still. So in a way, my noble quest or going forth was not from a palace, you know, of luxury and a spouse and a child, but it was from a life of sort of activism, activism and violence, really. So that was my going forth, and based on the sights that I had seen. So going back to Siddhartha, he once he's left home, he practices very intensively, and he becomes very accomplished in the dhyanas, in the dhyanas of form and the four formless dhyanas. But eventually he becomes dissatisfied with that. He knows that that isn't quite enough to provide him with the answers to the questions he's seeking. And so eventually he leaves those teachers behind. And he decides to start practicing extreme austerities with a group of ascetics. And very soon, he becomes so accomplished in that he becomes their leader, and he becomes very renowned throughout the whole region for the extreme nature of his practice. And it's good to imagine the context of northern India at that time. You know, it was a real hotbed of spiritual activity and exploration. One estimate that I've heard is that there were a third of the male population wandering around seeking enlightenment. I mean, it's just so hard to imagine that today. And within that, asceticism was a really strong trend, a strong current, and as indeed it became later in Judeo-Christian tradition as well. And the idea was, you know, very simply, you know, that through mortification of the flesh, spiritual freedom would be achieved. So the Buddha practices this for a long time until, you know, the story tells us that one day he went to the river to wash, and he's become so weak that he's nearly swept away by the current and drowned. And he then has a realization that the ascetic life has not really led him anywhere. And in fact, he's nearly died without, you know, getting the answers that he's seeking. So he goes back to his group and he tells them of this insight. They're not impressed. And so, again, there's a parting of the ways. He parts company with his fellow ascetics. And in that way, I think that in a way it was kind of like another going forth. And I think that that's an interesting idea for our spiritual journeys as well, because in a way we don't just go forth once in a big dramatic way into the spiritual life, leaving everything behind, and then that's it. You know, that's not the way that most of us do it, if any of us. For most of us, we take steps, we try things out, and then sometimes we find that things, you know, that it's not quite working out the way we'd hoped. And we have to have the courage to move on and to make changes. And we especially find this, I think, with the conditions that we set up for our spiritual practice, or that's in my experience anyway, that, you know, we might find that a particular job or even a particular friendship or relationship might be holding us back from truly living our lives the way we want to. And you know, we usually kind of, we know when this is happening because our life you know, things just don't seem, our life just doesn't seem to sort of resonate with what really matters to us. And, you know, well, it causes a lot of dissatisfaction and unhappiness, and basically we know we have to change something and to get back in contact with that deeper meaning. So the Buddha, well, he left his fellow ascetics, and then he decides, the next part of the story is he decides to take nourishment from a passing cowherd or a woman who gives him milk rice. And this is the first time in the account of the Buddha's journey to enlightenment, that a female figure has appeared in his story since he left his sleeping wife in the palace. And I like to think of this as sort of like a symbolic rebalancing of things. You know, like after this long period of semi-starvation and self-denial, the Buddha opens up again to the life-giving properties of nourishing food brought to him by a woman. And Sangharakshita has written about the meaning of this incident in the Buddha's life story as also being about the importance of being able to accept help on the spiritual path, being receptive. And he says that, you know, the way to enlightenment is very difficult, and that if we know that Siddhartha was able to accept help, then we shouldn't take lightly any help that is provided for us or offered to us on our journeys. And then next there comes a very beautiful part of the story, because the Buddha has a memory from his childhood. So after he's taken this nourishment, he has a beautiful memory from his childhood when he was watching his father plough the fields, and he sat down under a rose apple tree and had this spontaneous experience of great ease and contentment and bliss. And the story is a really simple one, which became greatly embellished in later Mahayana scripture, and it became very overlaid with symbolic detail. But the Buddha remembers his experiences, and he thinks that there's something about it that's pointing to the truth, that this is the way to go. So, you know, he realizes that he's not going to get anywhere with the ascetic practices, and he has an inkling that there's something about the simplicity and the happiness and the ease of sitting under this tree as a child that is pointing to the truth. So he recovers his health, and he then makes a pledge to sit underneath the Bodhi tree until he's fully enlightened. And then what comes next is the attack of Mara. And Mara throws everything in his arsenal at the Buddha. And what we're told is that the Buddha sits in perfect peace and equanimity while this horrendous attack goes on. And I'd like to do a reading about this incident, which I think gives a sense of really what the Buddha was up against here. It's quite long, but I think it's such a good one. So this is the Buddha speaking, and Mara is referred to by the Buddha as Namuchi. As I strove to subdue myself beside the broad Naranjara, absorbed unflinchingly to gain the true surcease of bondage here, Namuchi came and spoke to me with words all garbed in pity thus, "Oh, you are thin and you are pale, and you are in death's presence too. A thousand parts are pledged to death, but life still holds one part of you. Live, sir, life is the better way. You can gain merit if you live. Come, live the holy life and pour libations on the holy fires, and thus a world of merit gained. What can you do by struggling now? The path of struggling too is rough and difficult and hard to bear." Now Mara, as he spoke these lines, drew near until he stood close by. The Blessed One replied to him as he stood thus, "O evil one, O cousin of the negligent, You have come here for your own ends. Now merit I need not at all. Let Mara talk of merit then to those that stand in need of it. For I have faith and energy, and I have understanding too. So while I thus subdue myself, why do you speak to me of life? There is this wind that blows can dry, even the rivers running streams. So while I thus subdue myself, why should it not dry up my blood? And as the blood dries up, then bile and phlegm run dry, the wasting flesh becalms the mind. I shall have more of mindfulness, of understanding. I shall have greater concentration. For living thus, I come to know the limits to which feeling goes. My mind looks not to sense desires. You see a being's purity. Your first squadron is sense desires. Your second is called boredom. Then hunger and thirst compose the third, and craving is the fourth in rank. The fifth is sloth and acidity, while cowardice lines up as sixth. Uncertainty is seventh. The eighth is malice paired with obstinacy, gain, honour and renown besides, and ill-won notoriety, self-praise and denigrating others. These are your squadrons, Namuchi. These are the evil ones' fighting squadrons. None but the brave will conquer them. To gain bliss by the victory, I fly the ribbon that denies retreat. Shame on life here, I say. Better I die in battle now than choose to live on in defeat. There are ascetics and Brahmins that have surrendered here, and they are seen no more. They do not know the paths the pilgrim travels by. So seeing Mara's squadrons now arrayed all round, with elephants, I sally forth to fight that I may not be driven from my post. Your serried squadrons, which the world with all its gods cannot defeat, I shall now break with understanding, as with a stone a raw clay pot. So, it was quite a battle. and you can see, you can really sort of get a sense, I think, from that reading of what the Buddha was up against and how much he had to muster, in a way, to fight off Mara's squadrons. So that's one image, and then there's the other image of the Buddha, where there's all these demonic figures that are hurling the stones and the rocks and the weapons. But what happens is that when they hit the Buddha's aura, they just turn into blossom and flutter down to the ground. And I also like that image as well. And I think that image tells us something about the enlightenment experience as well, that the Buddha was able to sit with the experience of these demonic forces and not react. And I think that's the challenge to us, to sit with our own demonic forces and not react. And, for all of us, our demonic forces will take very sort of specific forms. We'll all have our own sweet formulations. And so it could be sexual fantasy, it could be cravings for food, alcohol, it could be boredom, it could be, getting lost and regret, it could be doubt, it could be any number of things. But if we're serious about our practice, what we try and do is that we sit with our experience, whatever is coming at us, and try our best not to act with anger or aversion. And if we're able to muster up enough strength to react with kindness, often to ourselves as much as to others, then the insults and the attacks are harmless. If we can turn to face our own particular Maras and really hold our ground, stand our ground, sit with our experience, not react, then basically everything that assaults us or assails us can just fall harmlessly around us. And for me, coming from my background of conflict and anger and activism, this really feels like my life's work, you know, to sit with everything and to develop a less reactive way. So it is different for everyone, but, you know, this is the stuff of our day-to-day practice, our practice of meditation, our practice of ethics, and our efforts towards wisdom. And it can be really tough, which is presumably why the Buddha said, "None but the brave shall conquer." So the Buddha sat on what's called the Vajrasana, the place where the universe first coalesced, according to tradition, where all the Buddhas past and present are said to have gained enlightenment. And when we sit down, we, in a way, have the same intention to occupy our ground, to occupy our space, to take our place in the world and to try and be fully ourselves. The Buddha took his place in the universe. And when we sit down, when we're fully present, we're fully present in the centre of our own lives, and that's really what we're trying to do. After his enlightenment, the Buddha spent quite a lot of time in the same area, sitting under trees, absorbing his experience and understanding how things arise and pass away. He had this really deep experience of what had conditioned him throughout many, many lifetimes, and of how it was possible to take full responsibility for his mental states. And ultimately, that's the only thing that we have any control over. We don't have much control over what happens in the world or what other people do, but we can choose how we act. And we can choose to act in a loving and aware way. And I think that there's going to be a talk later on in the year to this class, sort of picking up the story of the enlightenment and of what the Buddha did after he'd absorbed his experience. So I'm not going to say too much more now about the Buddha's actual experience of enlightenment, but I would like to take a few minutes to look at this question of whether it's possible for us to have a real living connection with the Buddha, or do we just think of him as this sort of dim, shadowy figure from the past, and, you know, he inspired some great art and left behind some great teachings, but, you know, he's kind of dead and gone. And, you know, I mean, a lot of us, I think, especially in the West, well, we tend to be quite intellectual, and maybe we think that it's more about the words of the Buddha, you know, that it's the words of the Buddha that matter more than the Buddha himself. But the interesting thing about in the Buddha's day was that, well, the Pali Canon is full of stories of people encountering the Buddha, and upon hearing him utter just a few words of Dharma, they become instantly enlightened, or they, you know, at least reach stream entry, breakthrough to stream entry kind of on the spot. And, well, you know, some of you have probably heard of the research which indicates that a very low percentage of meaning is actually communicated through the words themselves. And much more is often communicated through non-verbal factors, such as, you know, the person's face and, you know, voice and rhythm and, you know, the look of the person's eyes and the body language and all those sorts of things put together convey much more of meaning, the research tells us, than the words themselves. And... well, the Buddha clearly had an incredibly powerful impact on people from all walks of life. So not just, you know, the sadhus who were actively seeking the truth, or his fellow monks, you know, his direct followers, but also on people like Angulimala, who was the person who was chasing after him to kill him, or Kesagotami, who went to him because she was hoping that he might be able to heal her dead baby. You know, and they're examples of people who just, upon hearing him speak directly to them, you know, instantly achieved insight. So what do we do then, given that we're not lucky enough to have that personal contact with the Buddha in that way? Well, you know, what we have to do, I think, is to bring him to life in our imagination. So through stories, you know, so in a way that's partly why we have Wesak, so that we can tell the story of the Buddha and we can reflect on his life. And in that way we kind of build up our own sort of oral tradition as well. We recollect his life, we do visualization practices, and, you know, through devotion and ritual we can connect with the Buddha as well. I also really recommend, if people are able to and are interested, to go to India on pilgrimage and to visit all the sites, in particular the Mahabodhi Temple, which is where the Buddha, you know, the actual spot where the Bodhi tree was, you know, according to legend, where the, you know, the Buddha sat and gained enlightenment, and also other places where he taught, like Vulture's Peak, where he did a lot of his teaching there. You know, you can go on great pilgrimages in the Buddha's footsteps and go to some of these holy sites, and it really does bring it to life in a great way. But, you know, the key is about imaginatively connecting with the Buddha. And some of you may have heard the Pali Canon story of the old man Pingya, who tells his friend that he's become too old now to travel to see the Buddha. But he goes on to explain to his friend what he does instead. And he talks to him about how he imagines the Buddha. And he says, "There is no moment for me, however small, that is spent away from Gotama. With constant mindfulness, it is possible for me to see him with my mind as clearly as with my eyes, by night as well as by day. And since I spend my nights revering him, there is not a single moment spent away from him. I cannot now move away from the teaching of Gotama. The powers of faith and joy hold me there. This universe of wisdom draws me towards it. Physically, I cannot move like that. I am old and weak. The driving power of purposeful thought propels me constantly." And later, the Buddha tells Pingya that that practice of bringing him to mind, of imaginatively connecting with him, will lead him all the way to enlightenment. And what the Buddha says is, "Pingya, other people have freed themselves by the power of faith. You should let that power release you. You too will go to the further shore beyond the reach of death." So even in the Buddha's day, you know, he was still alive, but that imaginative connection with the Buddha was an important practice. And it was one that the Buddha encouraged, and one that was seen as being a path that could lead all the way to liberation. In one of the very important Mahayana sutras, the White Lotus Sutra, the Buddha appears to his followers in archetypal form, and he assures his followers that he's always present to those who have faith. And I'd just like to read that because I think it's rather nice. "When beings have faith, with upright characters and gentle minds, wholeheartedly wishing to see the Buddha, then I, with all the Sangha, am there on Vulture's Peak. If in another place there are other beings aspiring with reverence and faith, then I am with them also. You, not knowing this, think that I am dead and gone, but I see all living beings, and when their hearts are filled with longing faith, I appear to them to teach the Dharma. Throughout countless ages, I am always on Vulture's Peak and in every other place." So, if we just think about that on a purely rational level, we could get all caught up in, you know, debates about, you know, well, the Buddha isn't God and how can he exist after death and all those sorts of questions. But I think the words are not necessarily meant to be taken literally, but are pointing to something a bit deep and mysterious, and sort of a bit beyond the categories that we're used to. And that's, in a way, where we come back to the Buddha's enlightenment, because the Buddha's enlightenment is deep and mysterious, and reality is deep and mysterious. And I think, you know, for us to live a meaningful life, we need to live our lives as much as we can from, you know, with that sense and from depth and mystery. Yeah. So I think I finished a bit early.
That's fine. That's fine. Okay.